Welcome to Chasing American History. This is David Cross from Bowtie Tours, and today we are going to be talking about George Washington. We're going to return to our George Washington series. If you have not heard our earlier episodes, you want to go back and hear episodes 1, 2, and 3. And if you have heard them, then we're ready to roll with episode 4. But before we get started, I want to give a shout out to the Great Courses series. These are courses. You can look them up at the Teaching Company, and they have courses that are about every imaginable subject with the best teachers that there are. I've been taking the Great Courses series for a number of years, over 10 years now, probably over 20 years now. A lot easier than it used to be. Used to get these big bulky boxes full of CDs, and now if you want it on video, if you want it on audio, if you want to just put it on your phone so you can listen to it as you go to work, you can do it pretty much immediately. So very different world we live in today. And one of the great advantages is to be able to hook up to the Great Courses series and to listen to some of these great people talk to you about music, about architecture, about art, and of course, about American history. Now, before we get started talking about George Washington, let me just tell you, it's I'm recording this on January the 4th from Philadelphia, and we are having an absolutely beautiful snow today, so I just want to bring you all into that. I guess there's some of you out there who live in places that don't have these kind of seasons. I love this stuff. I love the snow. I got up at 6:15, and I had to talk the dogs into going into this snow. Chip the poodle, he loves the snow. He's happy to do it. Buddy, the pit bull, not so much. She's not a big fan. Of course, she has less hair. But I put a coat on her. They also don't like the salt. Gets on your feet. But I brought him out before there was any salt. So we took a walk in the morning. I'll be out shoveling. But it's one of those nice shoveling days. The snow is light. It's beautiful out. The kids are off of school. Unfortunately, my wife's not off of work. She's still got to go to court today. It's not a terrible snow, but it's a beautiful snow. So always puts me in a good mood. You know, when I did my book about the presidential libraries, I drove throughout the entire country. And yeah, you get to California and you think, why don't I live here? Just absolutely gorgeous place. And part of me was tempted to just stop there and not return, but I would really miss this. I would really miss the snow. To me, it never gets old. It makes me feel like a little kid every time it comes out. And so I'm pretty excited to have this snow out here. I'm going to talk to you about George Washington, then I'm going to drag the dogs out into the snow again, and then go out and shovel, and looking forward to it. So anyway, just a little bit of local color before we get started. It's early 2018, and I'm excited that we're going to be getting back to the George Washington series. Each month we're going to do an episode on George Washington. We're going to do an episode on the Civil War and an episode on the Constitution for a little bit. And the fourth week, maybe we'll try something different. We'll have to see. I do want to do an episode that's about the George Washington tour. We do a 10-day George Washington tour that's going to be going in June 8th to 17th this year. And if you've got any questions about that, give us a call at 610-642-2410. There's nobody out there that's more interesting than Washington, or that's more worthy of getting to know. And we spend 10 days discussing George Washington and seeing some of the great places. And it what's nice about the Washington tour is it's kind of a combined tour. You know, with Jefferson, you get all the philosophy. Civil War tours, a lot of battlefields. Well, Washington's both. You get his philosophical side, you get his side creating the nation, and we also go to a number of battlefields. So don't want to get into all that right now, but if you have any questions, please give us a call at 610-642-2410, or check out our website at chasingamericanhistory.com. and go over to the tours section, tour packages, and you can see the discussion of the complete George Washington tour, which we're going to be offering again on June the 8th. It'll go from June the 8th to June the 17th. Also, if you're interested in other tours, bowtietours.com. That's the basic website that shows you all of the different tours we do on the Revolutionary War, on the battles, at Valley Forge. We have an Amish tour, and we have some Civil War tours on there. So check us out, and again, give us a call if you have any questions. All right. Now, when we left George Washington, we left him in not the greatest state because he's not feeling too good. He has dysentery. This is his moment. Braddock is about to go face the French at Fort Duquesne. George Washington has been waiting for this moment. George Washington wants a moment to really shine on the battlefield. His background has not been great. He's had some missteps. He's had some errors. Again, check out those first few episodes we've done. But while people in America, in Virginia anyway, are pretty proud of him, people in England think he's a complete buffoon. And they think he has really screwed things up pretty badly. He always wanted to be a British regular. That was his great ambition in life. He wanted to be a British regular. And he finds instead that he's not respected by the British at all. They think he stumbled into this war by firing on French citizens, and they think he signed a really idiotic document that admitted to assassination and allowed the French to get into this war. So they're not big fans, really, in a lot of ways, of George Washington. Well, this is his opportunity. This is where he can prove himself. He's gotten himself into this position really as General Braddock's assistant, really, in a lot of ways. And he's not getting paid, and he's willing to sacrifice getting paid to be able to retain his pride and not take a position which seems to be lower than the position he had prior to General Braddock and prior to the war really starting. After the war, things were reorganized in large part because the British were so unimpressed with George Washington's actions that they thought, we really can't trust the Americans on this thing. We'd better handle things ourselves. So that's exactly what they did. They handled things themselves. Anyway, Washington's off in dysentery, and they've divided the army into two, one to go ahead under Fort Duquesne and one to stay behind. And Washington's behind because Braddock tells him, listen, you're doing nobody any good, as sick as you are. But he makes sure that Braddock promises that when the action starts, he's going to call for him, and he's going to be out there to help in this, what he hopes will be a glorious battle. Now, up ahead, General Braddock is, if anything, even more confident that this battle is going to be a success and that it's going to easily be a success. You recall that in the last episode, we discussed General Braddock's conversation with Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin told him that he would probably need to be careful about the Indians, that the Indians really knew how to fight and that they knew the topography and that they were going to be a difficult foe to defeat. And General Braddock poo-pooed this. He said, well, yes, perhaps they're difficult for the American soldiers who are untrained, but it's impossible that these savages can in any way be a difficulty for the British army. So he really felt that that was a ridiculous thing to be concerned about, and he's marching in there with all of the arrogance of the British, thinking that this is going to be an easy victory. Now, the French are not overconfident at all. As a matter of fact, the French commander is very fearful the night before the battle. He's fearful that his Indian allies are going to disappear before the battle even starts. And he's fearful that if this is a head-on battle, that the French can't win it. He's going to ambush the British. And the reason is he realizes he needs to march, he needs to go forward in order to make sure that these Indians come along with him. So at first he's almost on his own. When his Indian allies at first are reticent to go along with him in this ambush, he says, "I'll do it alone if you won't join us." And they're impressed by that. They're impressed by his bravado, and they do join. And once the British are in sight, they attack kind of helter-skelter. They're going forward and attacking and then withdrawing, going forward and attacking and withdrawing. Now, had the French performed in the typical European style, you know, with the discipline and the etiquette that the British felt was necessary component of war, they probably would have been slaughtered. But they're not going to do that. Their manner of attacking and withdrawing is going to really mystify the British, really confuse them. And the French are able to surround the flanks. So the British are really in kind of a bad spot because they've got people firing at them from all sides. They're not even sure which direction they should be worried about the most. You got people shooting at you up ahead, you got people shooting at you to your right, and you've got people shooting at you to your left. Now, the biggest fear for people in that situation is you're going to get surrounded. If you have bullets coming at you from all directions. And the other difficulty is Braddock keeps telling him to just keep walking up and standing there, even though they're getting mowed down by the bullets. Beyond all of that, what the French are doing are the Indian parties, which are running into the melee with tomahawks and then withdrawing, just like the French are doing. And the British observe that these Indians are coming from high ground. Again, this concern that they're going to be surrounded. So it's into this scene of just real confusion that George Washington finally arrives on to the battlefield. Now, all his life, George Washington has wanted nothing more than to be a British regular. All his life, George Washington has been given these tales of British military prowess. They never lose. They never lose their composure. And he comes in and he sees a total mess. Now, the regulars, recalled Washington, were immediately struck with such a deadly panic that nothing but confusion and disobedience of orders prevailed among them. This is a real awakening for George Washington. Wow, the British are people too, just like the rest of us. To his disgust, Washington saw that officers were acting, although very bravely, very foolishly. You know, they've been trained to send people forward in perfect formations. That's what you do if you're in the British Army. They're failing to comprehend, or they don't care, that standing in formation against an army that refuses to do so is an invitation to slaughter. If the French are hanging back and they're staying behind trees and they're running forward and running back and they're lying on the ground and shooting, and the British are just standing forward like bowling pins, it's not going to work out too well. Now, this whole time, Braddock is riding back and forth and exhorting his men to keep marching up into these columns, marching into these lines where they are being mowed down. And Washington is told to give these orders. And so Washington, despite knowing that these are ridiculous orders, that this is a foolhardy and foolish way to conduct a battle, he's telling these people to do this. And most of the Virginians are ignoring him. The Virginians aren't, you know, you get a real disparate way of acting between the Americans and the British here. The British have been trained. You know, it's going to help the Americans in the Revolutionary War just to move forward a little, that they don't follow orders unthinkingly. Their lives are going to be saved by that. You know, there's a level you have to have obedience. You have to have an army that follows orders. On the other hand, the Americans are going to be saved by not following stupid orders in the future. And this is one of those days where Braddock telling them to stand up in formation, they're not going to do that. That's ridiculous, and they're not going to do it. So the Virginians are looking at the British and thinking them fools, The British are looking at the Virginians and thinking them cowardly and undisciplined. There's a difference between these people, you know? And that's going to show in the future war that they're going to have against each other. Now, Washington's riding from officer to officer. There's a hail of bullets, and he's giving out Braddock's orders. As I say, he knows that they're ridiculous. Now, Washington would later note that any movement towards self-protection was discountenanced by General Braddock. So anyone who's trying to save themselves, get behind a tree, lie down, you know, again, that's cowardly, that's not following orders, that's not disciplined. Thomas Lewis wrote this about the scene. Here was a microcosm of the titanic, unseen, and largely unremarked clash of cultures taking place within British America, even as it grappled with its enemies. Here, in an army under severe stress, the dispute reached flashpoint with fatal consequences. On the one hand were the British officers, Eastern aristocrats, attempting to impose their will on events and people, insisting on obedience and discipline before all else, certainly before common sense and even before survival. On the other were the provincials, Western pragmatists, deaf to orders that made no sense, alert to effective methods, and eager to implement them. So, the Virginians are moving ahead and engaging with the French, sometimes to great advantage, only to find themselves under attack by their British brethren, who are firing at anything that's moving in the woods. They're just standing there in these lines. Now, Dr. Alexander Hamilton of Annapolis later wrote that, "Many more of our men were killed by their own party than by the enemy, as appeared afterwards by the bullets that the surgeons extracted from the wounded." So what you're looking at here is total craziness, all right? Nobody knows what's going on. And try to imagine it. You're in the woods. You've got bullets flying everywhere. You got bullets from the left. You got bullets from the right. You got bullets from ahead. Now, if the Virginians do run up ahead, they're ahead. And so the British are firing towards the French. They're going to be hitting the Virginians. A scene of total confusion. And the battle continued in that way for over 2 hours. The Virginians ultimately saw that given cover, they could be relatively safe from their enemies. Braddock, however, refused to change his view, and he continues ordering them to get in line, stand at attention, so that they could be effectively shot. Now, General Braddock himself was shot, and that gives us a question. Who shot him? He might have been shot by his own men accidentally. He might have been shot by his own men on purpose. If I'm in that army and he keeps telling us to stand up in attention, I might shoot him in the back, I don't know. But he was shot through the right arm and side, and the bullet lodged in his lungs. The moment he fell to the ground, the British survivors all ran for the river. We're out of here, man. This is BS. We are out of here. And they turn around and they run. As Washington described it, they broke and ran as sheep before the hounds, leaving the artillery, ammunition, provisions, and every individual thing we had with us prey to the enemy. And when we endeavored to rally them in hopes of regaining our invaluable loss, it was with as much success as if we had attempted to stop the wild bears of the mountains. So the British are running. Again, think about this in terms of what George Washington, the effect this has on George Washington. I really believe that the reason that the Giants, the New York Giants football team, were able to defeat the New England Patriots that year, when the Giants were a wild card team and the Patriots were undefeated, was that they just played each other a few weeks ago. It's going to help Washington so much when he has to face the British that he was there with the British, and he sees this scene, and he says that he sees that they're not impossible to defeat. They're not gods. They turned around and ran as soon as their general went down, and he and the Virginians, of course, this is his version of events. You probably get different versions from different people. That's how these events always goes. But to his mind, they left their weapons, they left the cannons, they're running, and Washington and the Virginians are trying to stop them and are trying to retrieve the property. So this is going to have a huge effect on George Washington and how he sees the British in the future. It was basically every man for himself, and nobody stayed behind to help General Braddock, who's lying on the ground there. Now, Robert Orme recalled attempting to bribe soldiers to help collect their own general, but money has no meaning when you are scared for your life. Washington arrived, and he and a few others collected Braddock and took him with them. Braddock begged for his pistol, so he might die like an old Roman. Anyway, nobody gave him the pistol to shoot himself. Washington would never forget the scene of that battle. The dead, the dying, the groans, lamentations, and cries along the road were enough to pierce a heart of adamant. The gloom and horror of which was not a little increased by the impervious darkness. There was nothing left to do but to travel to civilization defeated. Braddock would murmur, "Who would have thought it?" How poignant, isn't it? Who would have thought it? Well, Franklin thought it. Franklin told him. It's important for those of us studying the American Revolution from the American side not to be biased, not to be homers, not to, you know, look at everything the British does as evil. But throughout our story, we're going to see a lot of arrogance that does not serve the British well. Hubris. They're going to show it again and again and again in their dealings with the Americans, and it's going to be the thing that defeats them, and it's what defeated them here. I mean, they're very cavalier about this battle. You know, Braddock didn't even send out reconnaissance to find out where the enemy was. He's, we're the British. We don't need to worry about that. We're going to walk up. We're going to, you know, Indians and French, please. Didn't do the things you need to do. Because he was so sure that they were going to win this thing and then and do so easily. And this, who would have thought it? Well, it was your job to think it, General Braddock. It was your job to be prepared, not to just be swept up in stories of British greatness, but to understand the actual battle ahead. And he didn't. He wasn't prepared for the Indians, and he wasn't prepared for the French. Kind of a strange thing that Braddock dies because they thought he was okay. They thought that the bullet did not lodge in a particularly dangerous place, and they thought he would be all right, but he did die. And Washington directed the burial. Now, they buried him in two blankets on the road that they were riding, unmarked, because they didn't want enemies to desecrate the body. And Washington saw to it that the spot where he was buried, they ran over it again and again and again with carriages. It wasn't recovered. You know, the reason they do this is so the Indians don't dig it up and as I say, desecrate it. It was discovered in the 1950s when a highway crew came upon the body while they were digging. And now there's a little plaque out there. I saw it when I was driving home from Fort Necessity when I visited out there, and there's this little plaque right off the side of the road that shows where General Braddock was buried. So here's Washington. He's sick. He had dysentery. It was amazing he could walk, let alone fight in that battle, and everybody agrees that he fought valiantly and bravely. You know, this is not a battle. I always tell people he hadn't won a battle before he was nominated general of the American Revolution, but this is not his fault. He did nothing that he need be ashamed of in this battle. He returns back to Mount Vernon sick, dispirited, must have been cheered up a little bit by the letter he received from none other than Sally Fairfax the next day, and she said, "Dear Sir, after thanking heaven for your safe return, I must accuse you of great unkindness in refusing us the pleasure of seeing you this night. I do assure you that nothing but our being satisfied that our company would be disagreeable should prevent us from trying if our legs would not carry us to Mount Vernon. But if you will not come to us tomorrow morning very early, we shall be at Mount Vernon." Well, here we have this seesaw thing with George Washington and Sally Fairfax. You know, at times she says, "Don't write to me directly. We shouldn't have any direct contact. That's improper. I'm a married woman. You're a young man." And then she'll write to him and say, "Why haven't you talked to me?" You know, this back and forth kind of thing. So anyway, as soon as Washington gets that letter, he does improve enough so that he can go over and visit Sally the next day. This battle is going to have tremendous effect on George Washington and on the future. He learned a number of things. Most important thing he learned, and it's going to become important in 1775, is that the British are as liable of running in fear as was any other soldier. You know, there's a great quote from Ulysses Grant where he talks about running up a hill with his heart pounding, terrified of the enemy, getting up there and seeing they had run down the other side, and then it coming as an epiphany that they had been as scared as him as he was of them. And then he says, I hadn't thought about it that way that day, but it's not something I forgot from that day forward. Words to that effect. So George Washington is going to realize, all right, they're just as willing to turn around and run and botch things up as anybody else. He never condemned General Braddock for his failure to alter his army's fighting style, but he learned from it. He would say, true, true, he was unfortunate, but his character was much too severely treated. Even in the manner of fighting, he was not more to blame than others. Of all that were consulted, only one person objected to it. So in other words, that's part of the whole British operation. Washington's principal lieutenant, Adam Stevens, was a little bit more direct. His Excellency found to his woeful experience what had been frequently told him, that formal attacks and platoon firing would never answer against the savages and Canadians. It ought to be laid down as a maxim to attack them first, to fight them in their own way, and go against them light and naked as they come against us. Now, Washington's not going to say that as directly as Adam Stephen did, but I think George Washington comes to believe that just as much, and probably Adam Stephen heard that from George Washington many times. Washington had argued with General Braddock about this time after time after time. You can't attack people. You can't stand in formation in front of people who are hiding behind trees shooting at you. Can't do it. Now, while Washington would later write accounts condemning the British for its failure to permit their men to fight the Indians in their own way, he would never criticize General Braddock. You know, that was his general. Okay, you don't do that. About Braddock, he would only say he fought bravely and he died a soldier's death. As to Washington, yes, it was a terrible defeat, but Washington had nothing to condemn himself over, and I think, if anything, this certainly helped his reputation that he had fought so bravely. A bit of bad luck that Braddock died, because Braddock surely would have recommended him for higher office. Washington, in fact, had been almost ludicrously brave, riding about throughout the battle and having bullets whirl through his clothing. Three of his horses were killed. We'll hear this again and again and again. George Washington is one of those people who puts himself into the most dangerous spots. And, you know, this was a matter of great distress to the people during the Revolutionary War, and sometimes his own aides would have to grab his horse and pull him away and almost order him, you cannot ride. You know, he was this tall man in this white horse, very conspicuous, and often his aides would have to keep him from putting himself into the most dangerous situations. But this was the first time he rides back and forth, his horses get killed from behind him, but he, of course, is untouched. Unfortunately, as I say, so that's just my county telling me there's been a emergency snow warning. So for those of you in California enjoying yourselves, just so you know. Anyway, as I said, with Braddock's death, Washington loses his last attempt to be a British regular. Washington can only rail at the unfairness of the British treatment of him. To his brother Augustine, he writes, I was employed to go a journey in the winter, when I believe few or none would have undertaken it, and what did I get by it? My expenses borne? I then was appointed with trifling pay to conduct a handful of men to the Ohio. What did I get by this? Why, after putting myself to considerable expense in equipping and providing necessaries for the campaign, I went out, was soundly beaten, lost them all, came in, had my commission taken from me, or in other words, my command reduced, under pretense of an order from home. I then went out, a volunteer, with General Braddock, and lost all my horses, and many other things. I have been upon the losing order ever since I entered the service, which is now near 2 years. So George Washington is definitely losing his patience with the British and the manner in which they treat him. It's obvious that there would have to be an attack on Fort Duquesne to avenge this loss. Who better than Washington to lead the attack? The one man who escaped the scrutiny of the last battle with his reputation enlarged rather than reduced. The House of Burgesses met in a special session and appropriated £40,000 for a reinvigorated Virginia regiment to be commanded by George Washington if he would do it. Washington permitted the solicitations of the country to overcome my objections. So here again we have this hope that George Washington has of being a true hero in a victorious battle. It's not enough to be a hero in a losing battle. That doesn't do your reputation enough. His first action after being given command was to travel to several other colonies, stopping off at Philadelphia and New York and Boston. Now, in Philadelphia, he spent far too much money. In New York, he spent a lot of time with a young heiress named Eliza Polly Phillips. Washington was fully aware that despite his deep attachment to Sally Fairfax, he was going to have to marry well, and he was going to have to marry money. You know, Washington's ambition is to be a member of the leading families. And there's probably only way he can do that, and that's by marrying into the money. You're not going to make the money on your farm. You're not going to make the money in the military. He's going to have to marry money. That's kind of how it's done in Virginia. He's not going to spend the rest of his life pining over Sally Fairfax, who's married to perhaps his best friend. Now, although Eliza had much money, she was also reputed to be strong-willed and even bossy. Something that Washington, after so many years dealing with his mother, was probably sure to avoid. In Boston, he met with the governor and again found himself negotiating so that his authority would not be usurped by others. He found Governor Shirley to be a consummate politician, not a compliment in Washington's eyes. And he spoke of resigning his commission due to the fact that the war was the usual contest of empire and ambition. Now, that's very interesting. You know, you could imagine Thomas Jefferson thinking something like that or saying something like that. Here's Washington, whose eyes are being opened to, if I'm going to put my life on the line, what do I put it on the line for? And now he's starting to wonder, is it even worth it? I mean, here's England fighting France. What difference does it make? The British have never shown any kindness to Washington or even fairness. Does it really matter? Why am I putting my life on the line to be a part of British desires for empire? Of course, any talk of resigning was just that, mere talk. He wants to be a military hero. And even if it's going to be done as a pawn in the game of British Empire, something he's now mature enough and insightful enough to see, still, he wants to be a hero, and he's going to use that for his ends. He's going to be a member of the House of Burgesses. He's going to marry a wealthy woman. All of these things are all leading to the same thing that he wants, which is to be a leading member of one of the top families of Virginia. Upon joining his men, Washington begins sending out an onslaught of petulant, angry letters to Dinwiddie, Governor Dinwiddie, arguing quite often with Dinwiddie's stated strategies. Now, John Furling is going to be very rough on George Washington, author John Furling. He calls it hyperbolic rhetoric. He calls the letters petulant, emotional, childish. But Washington thinks it's a mistake to fight a defensive war. He believes that the only way to win the war is by seizing the offensive and attacking Fort Duquesne with superior forces. Now, as things were, there were constant brief attacks occurring from the French and the Indians upon Virginia citizens. The only way to drive them out, he argued, was for them to attack. Now, this all might have been true, but unless and until England sent more men, there was very little Governor Dinwiddie could do. I mean, this is always the situation. Generals always want more soldiers, right? And then there's the president or the king or the whoever's in charge can only send so many people. Well, Governor Dinwiddie doesn't have a lot of power in terms of getting any more people to fight alongside George Washington. So, obviously it would be better to have more men, but I don't think there's much Governor Dinwiddie could do about it. So Dinwiddie, who's, you know, grown tired of George Washington already, is really just about had enough of this guy. It's going to be during this period that the relationship between Governor Dinwiddie and Washington absolutely collapses. He's been growing angrier, Dinwiddie, angrier and angrier over every critical... I mean, George Washington sent some very critical letters, and he sends letters to other people. And this comes back to Dinwiddie. You know, all the kind of things we think Washington would never do. You know, the Washington that we know, the Washington of the American Revolution... all the kind of things we think he would never do, he does as a younger man. He's going to learn from this, though. There's very few people who change. I'm here in a room full of biographies, and the number of people who really change are few. But as we're going to see, George Washington is going to change. But back then, no, he is petulant. He is emotional. He is too talkative. And he's writing letters to people, complaining about Governor Dinwiddie. And Governor Dinwiddie has just about had it with him. Now, when Washington complained that the governor's directives were constructed so awkwardly as to leave him in a state of uncertainty, without knowing the plan of operations or what scheme to go upon, and that he had to guess at everything. So here's Washington complaining about his grammar, Dinwiddie's way of writing. That's it for Dinwiddie. When Washington revisited his troops at the front to find them disorganized, he complained that the fault was not his, but his superiors. Now, James Flexner would write, "Washington's report read less like those of a commander than of an investigating committee about to recommend that commander's removal. In urging governor and council to mend their ways, he was peremptory, addressing them as if they were the subordinates, not him." Not surprisingly, the governor and council took great umbrage, were very upset about this. They took the management of the campaign out of Washington's hands after sending him orders that implied that he was to blame because he had neglected his duty by avoiding danger and failing to place his headquarters in the front line where it belonged. Washington was ordered to march to Cumberland, and Dinwiddie added that he had had enough of Washington's unmannerly criticisms. Now, at this time, Washington decided to attempt to go around Governor Dinwiddie. You know, it's tough to go through this period of Washington's life because you want to go back. You want to get in a TARDIS and go back and say, don't do this. Worry about your army. But he's immature. And he thinks he can go around Governor Dinwiddie and convince Governor Dinwiddie's superiors in Philadelphia to back his idea of attacking Fort Duquesne. Now, when Washington requests permission to go to Philadelphia, Dinwiddie, who clearly knows exactly what Washington is planning to do, and just as clearly knows he's not going to get anywhere with it, he gives him permission, but not without commenting on Washington's continual absence from his own army. Again, we will learn lessons from this, will George Washington. He's never absent from his army during the Revolutionary War. When he has to go out to Philadelphia, they want to give him parties. He says, no, I got to go back to my army. He stays with his army. He's going to learn from this period of time. But back then, he's never with his army. He's always off doing this. He's running around here. He's not in the proper headquarters. Now, Washington arrives at Philadelphia to meet with Earl Loudon to convince him to back his plan and, most importantly, to incorporate the Virginians into the regular British army. Good luck with that, George. Loudon makes Washington wait for over a week, and then he blandly told him that no attack would be made at Fort Duquesne that year, and he ordered him to take his men to South Carolina, which was in great distress. He refused to, you know, explain himself, and he wouldn't even listen to Washington's complaints about either the plan or the treatment of Virginia. Having failed to convince Loudon, Washington returned to sending letters to Dinwiddie, arguing that the Virginia regiment had absolute right to permanent establishment. "We can't conceive that being Americans should deprive us of the benefits of British subjects," he wrote. Governor Dinwiddie, however, had had enough, not only of Washington, but of Virginia and the colonies and all of it. Tired, old, having suffered a series of strokes, he decides to retire and to return to England. and he wrote to Washington that, "My conduct to you from the beginning was always friendly, but you know I have great reason to suspect you of ingratitude. I wish my successor may show you as much friendship as I have done." Now Washington, who must have known in his heart that Dinwiddie's absolutely right, he wrote back, "I do not know that I ever gave your honor cause to suspect me of ingratitude, a crime I detest." And he requested leave to come to Williamsburg to meet with Dinwiddie and to settle accounts, to talk it out, maybe hug it out. But Dinwiddie says no. You don't want to see him. "You have frequently been indulged with leaves of absence. Surely the commanding officer should not be absent when daily alarmed with the enemy's intentions to invade our frontiers, and I think you are in the wrong to ask it. You have no accounts that I know of to settle with me." That's it. Pat it with you. Now, this is going to prove to be the addendum of a relationship that started well and ended disastrously. The importance of the relationship is what Washington evidently learns from it. You know, as I've already said, the sad story of human beings is they don't learn. Here, though, George Washington makes mistakes, and there's nothing that says he says they were mistakes. There's nothing that says he's sorry that it happened. There's nothing where he admits to being in the wrong. But you go through his life and you just see that he never makes those kind of mistakes or anything approaching those kind of mistakes again. He's very much more careful. He's never arrogant with the Congress. He's never arrogant with John Adams or Hancock. He's never arrogant with his superiors when he returns. And so we as students, we as biographers, we as historians, we don't have a piece of paper where he wrote down, "Gee, I learned from this." But we notice that these are mistakes. Not only did he not make these particular mistakes, he's better in these areas than just about anybody else that you can ever come upon. However, that lesson isn't going to be learned immediately. Now we come to the issue of what road to create. Remember, we talked about this in an earlier episode. There's two possible roads. One would go through Pennsylvania. One would go through Virginia. Of course, the Virginians want the road that will go through Virginia, because if the army makes a road for whatever purposes, well, after the war is over, you've got a road there. And they need a road that's going to help them in terms of getting out west and doing all of the things that the Virginians want to do. So George Washington has always been pushing for this Virginia road. Now, most historians who look at the issue say, no, the Pennsylvania road just made more strategic sense for this situation and for this war. But Washington wants the road through Virginia. Again, we're looking at this period of George Washington really to see what he learns from, and he's going to be very careful to be for the whole country in the future and not just for his state of Virginia. But back then, he wants that road. General John Forbes is a 50-year-old Scotsman with many years' military experience in Europe, and he is given the command of the campaign to take Fort Duquesne. He orders Washington to see to the construction of a 40-mile-long road linking Forts Frederick and Cumberland, but he needed to decide whether to use the road Washington had created, the one in which Braddock had been buried, or to create a new road straight west. Influential Virginians wanted him to take what was known as the Braddock Road, for reasons I've said. Influential Pennsylvanians wanted the new road to go through Pennsylvania. Based on purely military considerations, Forbes is going to choose the Pennsylvanian road. "Not only would there be one less major river to cross," he said, "but logistical support could flow to the army from heavily populated eastern Pennsylvania, and the supplies could be stored in a series of easily secured magazines that could be constructed along the new road." Okay, well, that sounds very sensible, doesn't it? That makes sense. Washington adamantly argues for using the old road, and by doing so, he loses the respect of his new commander, who could see that Washington held his attachment to his province before the good of the army. All right? That's, you know, and it's clear he does. The one goes through two rivers. The other one is near more populated areas. It's not that hard to figure out what's going to be the better road for these uses. And when George Washington starts to argue this, well, he's worried about this company that's purchasing land out west. He's not worried about the good of the army. He says, Washington, "All is lost. All is lost, by heavens. Our enterprise is ruined." So there you have kind of the tone of George Washington that's really starting to grate on everybody. Now soon he's going to become involved in an even greater tragedy. After 200 enemy raiders struck a supply post at the halfway point along Forbes' new road to Ohio, Forbes sent several hundred Virginians to pursue the attackers. When he felt that he had not sent enough, he sent more. Now, it's unclear which of the two forces Washington commanded, but what is clear is that the two forces ended up tumbling into each other and shooting at each other. This is another, you know, Washington's had some bad events in his life here, and here's another one. This battle is going on between these two armies are from the same side. Now, Washington, he did not write about this for 30 years. And at that point, he's going to blame the commander of the other detachment and say that he deserved credit for stopping it before it turned into greater carnage. We only have one account of the incident from the time, and that's from Captain Thomas Bullitt, who believed Washington was responsible not just for the calamity, but for doing nothing to stop the bloodshed. He added that this was also the view of several of the officers. After Forbes decided to attack Fort Duquesne using the new road, Washington again wrote to him advising him to use the Braddock Road and predicting defeat if he was not listened to. Forbes ignored Washington, promptly defeated the French at Fort Duquesne. So there's a real anticlimax here. George Washington arrives at Fort Duquesne. You know, through all this time, in his mind, he's going to win this great battle in Fort Duquesne. And he's lost it all by being obnoxious, by being childish, and by caring more about Virginia and his monetary future than the army. His victory is empty, and his counsel is no longer required and no longer sought after. He's lost respect of everybody. When Washington retires now, it's going to be for good. Nobody's going to come and ask him to get out of retirement. People have had it with George Washington. To take account of Washington's military career at this point is to see a career that at times showed potential, but that is marked by failure and not by victory. We have a young man who attacked the French at Fort Necessity, causing a worldwide controversy and a world war. The same man then took part heroically but unsuccessfully in the tragic battle at Fort Duquesne. He then became involved in an incident of friendly fire in which he is blamed for causing a battle between two friendly armies. 40 men were killed and wounded. And it should be noted that he spent a lot of his time away from his army. He's going back and forth from Mount Vernon and back. And he did himself no good by the letters he wrote to Dinwiddie, to other people, by going around Dinwiddie. You know, at the end of the day, one cannot say that this had been a successful career in any way. But his great failures are not military. They're political. And in the political, he failed in every measurable manner. At the time of this retirement, he had not garnered a good reputation from any of his commanders, civilian or military, except for Braddock, who died. His advice had been considered to be hot-headed and provincial, showing more concern for his own interests than others. His letters show an emotional, petulant, childish side. This is a guy who needed to grow up. Fortunately, he will. When we return to see Washington as he commands the next army, as I say, and I've said it a couple times now, he's going to show that he's changed dramatically. But all that change and all those good things he's going to do, you're going to start hearing about in the next episode, episode 5. So until then, chasing American history, chasing American history, we're chasing American history, my friends. We're chasing American history, chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Well, on Washington, you've had episode 4. We're gonna give you a whole lot more. Chasing American history, my friends. Father of the country will be his fate, but on this episode he wasn't so great. Chasing American history, my friends. And so we're chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Well, he was in love with his best friend's wife. He loved her his entire life. Chasing American history, my friends. But the truth was not so funny. He needed a woman with lots of money. Chasing American history, my friends. And so we're chasing American history. Chasing American history. You know, we're chasing American history, my friends. Chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. General Braddock acted insane, so they lost it for Duquesne. Chasing American history, my friends. He said, we'll beat the French, of course. Washington smoothed his grave with his horse. Chasing American history, my friend. Oh, now we're chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. Chasing American history. Chasing American history. We're chasing American history, my friends. See ya on episode 5.